Start. Okay, I will start this lecture on the lambda phage. The lambda phage is one of the very standard systems in biology, and it's a phage where really a lot of things is known. Some people claim that they understand it completely. I would claim that we don't understand it so much. We understand quite a lot. But something is lagging. So I will first describe how the phage actually works. I don't know how many of you have heard about the lambda phage. It's a phage, it's a virus that infects E. coli. E. coli you have all heard about. E. coli is a bag of proteins which is around 1 micrometer across. And this bag has some, of course, DNA and protein inside. And then it can be, well, it can be attacked by this phage. The phage is maybe looking like this here. It's roughly this size relative to the E. coli. It finds a receptor. It can go into coli, which has maltose receptors on the surface. It cannot go into other coli. That makes it nice because, what? It's a maltose receptor. So it finds coli with this maltose receptor. Bind to it, eject its DNA into the E. coli, and then something happens. Mostly what happens is actually that the phage kills the E. coli. That's kind of standard. Tomorrow you will hear another phage that always kills the host. That's a T7. Many phages always kill the host. But some phages does not always kill the host. They have an alternative strategy. And that's what made lambda. It was kind of revolution when one first found lambda, because it has actually, it can decide, it's not just a stupid killing machine, it sometimes decides not to kill. And it decides not to kill, especially under some conditions, so it actually even think about what goes on. So let me draw the decision circuit of this system. It's essentially, the lambda phage is a long piece of DNA here. It's 40,000 base pair long. In the middle of this piece of DNA, there is kind of a little brain. This little brain consists of an operator right complex, which is really the core of the system. On the left of this, there is the possibility to transcribe a protein called the repressor protein, which is C1. On the right, there is the possibility to transcribe a Cro protein here. And the decision the lambda phage make is whether to transcribe this or this. If this is transcribed, it goes back to this operator complex and block. This operator complex is not a point, it's three small points here, each of them 20 base pair, called 1, 2, and 3. And C1 binds preferably to 1. That's known from biochemistry experiment. It's kind of extremely well studied, the biochemistry of this system, especially due to Akkers. We know how much it binds in vitro to this one, and this one. It's curves that looks somehow like this here experimentally. So here is a C1. This is kind of the measurement of binding affinity. Here you have the concentration of C1 dimer in some solution. And here you measure the fraction of C1 that bounds to the operator 1, to the operator 2, and to the operator 3. And you see that you need very little C1 concentration to bind to operator 1, which is this one. So C1 likes to bind to this one. And then it binds to this, and then it binds to that. Cro, on the other hand, which is shown up there, is kind of opposite. It binds strongly to 3, which is this one. And now the promoter for C1 is overlapping with 3 here. That means that if Cro comes in and blocks, then it blocks this transcription. If the promoter for Cro overlaps with 1 and 2. So if If C1 binds to this, then it blocks transcription this way. So this is a kind of switch. You can only be in two states here. Either you are in this state and you suppress this, or you are in this state and then you suppress this. Yeah.
And you either kill a cell or don't.
Yeah.
And this is the thumb.
And this is the thumb. So now first you have to make a decision of what to do. So the emperor doesn't really know what to do. So this thing just comes into the DNA, into the cell. There's just this DNA floating around. This promoter is active. This promoter is active. This promoter is not very active, actually. This promoter demands itself. It's like we heard from Savasher yesterday, this is normally in highly expressed in the lysogen, so it kind of needs itself to be expressed. There's a positive feedback from C1 to C1 that the C1 binding to this side facilitates RNA binding here and RNA polymerase binding here, and then it goes this way. So if it just was this system here, and it goes into the cell, it would always essentially express Crow. Crow would win.
And Crow kills the cell?
Crow kills the cell, effectively. Now, but first let me, it comes, now, this is not the decision circuit in the beginning. There's something else happening out here. There's a promoter. This promoter here is PR, and this here is called PRM. For repressor maintenance, and this one here, there is a promoter firing this way, PRE, on this point. And this promoter, when that is activated, it fires this way, read an anti-Crow that doesn't make anything, and then it reads the C1. And this one promoter is not firing by itself; it needs another molecule that's called C2 out here, which actually is made from the Crow promoter itself. So when the Crow transcribe from here, it transcribed this way. Unfortunately, there's a little stop sign here, so it does not always pass this point. But sometimes it passes and make the C2 go back here. In the entry, so it's kind of getting steadily a little bit more complicated. This entry decision is a little bit complicated. It has to respond to many things. So if one should understand that, one really needs essentially too much knowledge at present to model it. So to pass this terminator sign, there is another promoter on this side, over here, which is called the promoter left, and that is controlled by operator left complex. A copy of this one. It's roughly a copy of this complex. It has near the same binding energies as this one. It's a little bit weaker bindings, typically 1 kilocalories per mole. Weaker binding, but it very much looked like this complex. It's kind of probably made evolutionary by a copy over there. This one, when this is read off, which is in the beginning, there's nothing that prevents this from read off, it reads off the N protein, which is extremely fashionable in the moment to study. Many people has many labs just studying N proteins. Von Hebel talked, I think, one of his talks essentially, about the N protein. N protein is the anti-terminator protein, and it's very important it's important in HIV, it's important in many viruses. Its function is that it allows the RNA polymerase, when it starts, to go on and pass stop signs along the way. So when this one is on, you can essentially continue transcribing the whole genome. And you can also continue transcribe over this point. So in the beginning, you just fire over here. You get the C2. The C2, if nothing else happens, the C2 likes to go back here and bind, activate PIE, and you have a fight between PIE firing and giving C1 and the Crow. And it's this fight which decides the outcome in the initial state. This fight is is in itself meaningless because it needs to have a function, and the function is that C2 sends the state of the cell. C2 is rapidly degraded, and the rate at which it's degraded depends on the state of the cell. If it's kind of starving, it degrades with a different rate than if it's not starving. So there's a sensing of the state of the cell. There's another part of the fight, that is if maybe two viruses are injecting at the same time, which is quite often. You are in a culture and a virus burst out and maybe many viruses inject at the same time. That means that you have many copies here that are firing this way. There's also many copies that fire this way, but Cro also binds to 2 and 1, so Cro shuts itself off. So that means if there's many viruses that enters, then the system tends to favor PRE, and that means that it goes into lysogeny, which is kind of intelligent because if there's many phages around, there's no need to kill the cell and make new phages because you know that in the surrounding, all over, there's many phages. So this is the entry. When it then succeeds to go into this state, it can stay there quite some time. It can stay there a surprisingly long time.
The virus DNA is inserted into
bacterial DNA in a particular place in the chromosome, and that that's further downstream here and here. It's not part of the IQ of the lambda. It's kind of following when this one is. It is many, 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 many generations. It is of order depending on, I will come to that, but it is somewhere between 10 to the 5 and or to 10 to the 9 generations. A little bit depending on which perturbations you allow. Somewhere in the middle you set in by mutation instability. But in itself, this system is so stable that if you only look at number fluctuations, just noise in the system, you have stabilities of this order, which is very long time. That means that you typically, when you leave one bacteria overnight, you maybe have 10 to the 9 bacteria the next morning, and then maybe 10 to the 3 of them has bursted. Yeah?
10 to the 9 generation until you have one state, or
you order half? Now this number is kind of a little bit fluctuating in literature. It depends. So this one is with reg A plus. Now I have not that I have to tell you why that means something here. This one is with reg A minus, and you really disregard all mutations. All kind of mutations.
So when you say once it has
committed,
once it has decided to go to lysogeny,
yes,
is it then immune to future?
Yes, that it's actually nice for the bacteria when it has the phage in it. It's when if it doesn't have any phages and the phage enter, it will be killed quite often, depending on condition, but maybe 90% of the time or 99% of the time. If it has a phage into it, it's basically immune to the lambda phage. It's just that was really the discovery was kind of in Monod's lab in the 50s where they UV radiated cells for something else, and then they suddenly saw that they bursted all the cells, and some cells didn't burst and some cells bursted. And if you had started with a single cell colony that has grown, it was either on or off, and that was very. So now comes the so it stays there for a long time, and then it at some point
it.
Yes, but you don't do one. You don't follow one generation experiment. If you follow 10 to the 9 bacteria. You see it, but it's just. Amazingly stable system. So now when we talk about fluctuations, I will talk about fluctuations essentially here. This is kind of the edge of the distribution is kind of quite small. It's weird. And it's kind of an exercise to try to understand that. Okay. So now it then has to staying there. It, of course, its purpose is not just to stay there. Its purpose is to stay there is that the bacteria replicate, and each time the bacteria replicate, it replicate the lambda. And that's nice if the bacteria is happily living inside us. It replicates fast and they get many copies of the lambda. Now, the reason for jumping out is, of course, that you also should have essentially, if the bacteria is going to die, it's good to take the material of the bacteria, make it to lambda phage, and leave the jump ship. And this is sensed by the system to the RegA. So we have heard talks about RegA. RegA has something to do with DNA repair. Dipsy Bear talked about RegA. And RegA also have some kind of cleavage property that it can cut proteins into two. In particular, it can cut C1 into two. C1 is, well, we should know what C1 is. C1 is a two-domain protein, which has two domains. They have each their function. This one is DNA binding, and this one is a dimerization domain. So it can bind another C1. And the purpose of having a dimer is Plasner talks at length about it. That of course you if you bind this one binds with maybe 5 kilocalories per mole. To this piece of DNA, and this one bind with 5 kilocalories per mole, the whole thing bind with 10 kilocalories per mole, and that's a lot more than 5 kilocalories per mole. So you kind of, this one can actually bind to this side with some efficiency. If it was only a monomer, it would bind with 5 kilocalories per mole, and that would be nothing. It would go off. So when you cut this here, which the RegA does, then this one is not binding to this side. That means that it doesn't block the crow. The crow fires, and the system go to lysis. And the whole system is probably fine-tuned, so you can measure something like as function of UV radiation, which is DNA damage. You can measure the percentage chance that you're killing your cell, and you get some kind of step function like this here. So here you kill all the time, and here you doesn't kill, and it's a kind of step function in chance to kill cell. And this curve is matching the chance that the bacteria die due to this radiation, due to the similar. If you chance, the chance that the bacteria actually die is similar to this threshold. So it's kind of matched to that. Okay. So. So now we have the exit that it really wants, the entry as it is described. Yeah.
UV, how does it connect with this Reg A
is with UV light you break the DNA of the E. coli.
Right.
This E. coli senses that it activates Reg A, which is part of the SOS response. So that gets and the Reg A. And kill and split C1. So it has this. It has apparently several functions. It has also RegA has a kind of. It's.
It's not known why it's always good to split that protein.
Well, this one is certainly not good for the bacteria to split that one, but it has this function somewhere else in the cell.
Yeah. Well, it comes from Lex A, right? So Lex A does the same thing.
With Lex A. Okay.
So when that's the one, it's called think of the
Yes, yes.
It's a pre-existing thing, part of this whole idea.
So, yeah. Yes. So now, in between these two decisions, it has to maintain the state. And our approach to learn about this system is to study the maintenance of the switch. The reason to study the maintenance is that this is the simplest part of the network. The maintenance is essentially this here. It's whether you fire here or you fire here. When you switch from here to here, you go Lüdig. That is basically true. There is So when you have the crow, you go Lüdig. It's not entirely obvious that it's like that. One could argue that crow could go over there and block over here. There's been some speculations about whether crow could block this one in itself. That is never seen, and the binding of crow to this side is quite weak. It's weaker than here. So this one, and also it's measured that even with crow, the firing here is quite active. So there's no reason to believe any rescue out there. So the decision to Lüdig is here. So we can just model this system when we study the stability. That means we are down to a level where physicists can work. And this system is also extremely well measured. It's essentially this measurement here that shows its measurement actually finished a year ago. And there has been updates of measurement. Yeah? What is not understood is now, so everything, well, no, not everything about lambda is understood. Essentially, the preview is that this here could work, but there is an order. The whole story about the lambda is that this one is 1, 2, 3, where C1 binds to this time and crow binds to this side. Now there have been measurements last year where you change the system, you mutate it, you test the robustness of the switch, essentially. So you look at a mutant that's called 3-2-3, and you look at a mutant that's called 1-2-1. And the basic result was that they work fine. They shift the threshold down a little bit here, but basically they work. And that challenges the view of this ordering. These stabilities are influenced, like the threshold there. Actually, the stabilities and the level of the threshold follows each other. And the stabilities are reduced to, in this case, it's reduced to something like 10 to the, so if it's in wild type, is 10 to the minus 7, then this is 10 to the minus 5, and this is 10 to the minus 4, something like that. Frequency switching.
But from here, if you just switch the order,
it would not work.
Why not?
Some of it works, some of it doesn't work. The thing that happens now is that in 1-2-1 case, you are. So now I'm jumping a little bit ahead, but this one is working actually. The 1-2-1 is working. It could work. It's fine. It could work. The 1-2-1 is working because the 1-2-1 is the one where C1 binds. There's still strong suppression of crow. The one just shut itself off more faster, so the level of C1 is lower in this system, but it still suppresses crow. The 3-2-3, on the other hand, C1 is still, but at a lower rate because it goes down and binds here and blocks itself. So it goes down by a factor 4. But it still works. And if you plug it in, it basically could work. Well, that's what he did. So that's where the data are. Yeah, that's the one that has been done. So it's the only reason. The 3-2-3, on the other hand, that works fine here, but it puts a tree over there. And that means that the gap here, which is like, you see, it's kind of two orders of magnitude, maybe. So two orders of magnitude weaker suppression of crow. So you have two orders of magnitude more crow in your system. And that's difficult to get that to work, because you suddenly have a system which you understood as being either a lot of C1 and essentially no crow. Now you have a lot of C1 and a factor 100 more crow. And if the switching was something like, well, a factor 100 means an enormous amount. Yeah, so it essentially breaks down if you, yeah? It will limit itself. Oh yeah, it would. But in this case, it would limit itself. Sure, it would limit itself. It would limit itself. But still being sufficiently much to shut C1 off. It will limit itself to. But the limits of crow on itself is where the crow number is of order some hundreds in the cell. Now we're really jumping. Yes. No, that's probably not what is happening. The reason why, so what you're suggesting is that the crow go down here and bind here, which is somewhat happening, that the crow binds here, but the crow is not blocking this very efficient. There's experiment by Shankar and they looked at expression from here as function of crow, and you need to have to block this one, you need quite a lot of crow in the system. And that's.
If I go back to the original story about the switch and it's one or the other that's bound there, I mean, at a crude level of resolution, something you could imagine that it would work, even if there weren't any difference between the
switch. Oh yeah, it also works actually in the model of 1-to-1.
Right. So
it can work.
In a way, it's not a surprise. Right?
In a way, it's not a surprise. That's true. The thing.
The requirement of having 1-to-3 different and having the affinities going in the opposite direction.
No, the only problem here is that it's a qualitative statement that whether when you have much more crow in your system, that it still works. Quantitative statement. Quantitative statement. Sorry.
I thought the simple thing was that once crow started going, it blocked the other direction, which was.
So we really when so this is kind of complicated.
The
system.
What was the other direction?
So C1 is here.
And so it would block C1. And when C1 got going, it would block crow. And now you say if you make the crow and C1 each block themselves as well as the other one, that's the
crow.
So 1-to-1.
Mm-hmm. 1-to-1 is a kind of.
It would block C1, but it would also block itself.
Would block C1 at crow would block C1, yes, it would block
C1 would block crow, but it would also block itself.
Yeah.
And that still works.
The 1-to-1 is the 1-to-1 is a C is as there's little crow and there's still very fairly well suppressed system. I should draw the curves you get from this binding energy too. But C1 is present at some low level. The 3-2-3, the one is transcribing, there's somehow a similar amount of C1 in the system, but there's a much more crow in the system because it's this part of the system. So it's a system where you have a factor 100 more crow, essentially, than in the wild type.
Uh-huh.
What? No, it has not been measured. We are trying to measure that now, but we haven't measured it. We want to do it with GFP, essentially. Oh yeah, that's only when crow takes over the system. It's still mainly repressed by C1. Well, then you are going into as soon as crow begins to dominate and repress itself, then you are in the anti-immune state. You are in a state which is dominated by crow. This system, so that is the one that's actually switching. So let me maybe I should retrace and
What happens with these mutants in, or whatever, in, under infection? And you described what happened in the wild type when there's a phage infection. But what happens in the initial decision?
Ooh, I have. So this is a. So there's some.
I think you're full of talk. We should let you.
Yeah, maybe I'm jumping. Okay. Let's come back to that. Okay.
The thing that we're going to learn from you is all the things that are not understood that have to do with this kind of experiment.
Exactly. Good. Exactly. Good. Yes. Exactly. Yeah. Well, yeah. Exactly. It's kind of yes. Okay. So let me. So what? Of course, what I'm doing when one start modeling this here is that one essentially believe that this data has some sense, and that is up to discussion.
These are data just for one attachment at a time.
It's both data for one attachment at a time and for cooperativity. This data are very detailed cooperativity measurement. You see, you also see that, so here it's just one at a time, but in these papers they also do two, all pairwise combination and all triple combinations and do everything. It has been a very long and tedious study where Akas, I think Akas Akas and Darling in this paper, but Akas over the last 20 years has refined this to
This is one at a
time. I just show one. Down here is kind of, you see some kind of robustness against pH change, that you see that these numbers are kind of keeping the same order, roughly the same distance as function of pH. And down here is a cooperativity. This is 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, and 1, 2, so all kind of pairs. The latest reference is Darling and Akers in last year, last July. Footprinting. It's a kind of way where you bind you take the piece out you're measuring. Maybe you take one operator out. First you take one operator of each type, and a piece of DNA, and then you let your the thing that binds the fraction of DNA that's bound and some of the operators not bound, and you want to measure that, and then you had some enzyme that degrade all the DNA that's not bound, and then you measure what is left over, and then you do that for all combinations. So and you end essentially with a kind of table like this here, which was the current status of the biochemistry, which is taking all binding energies of all possible states of this little system here. So there's C1, there's Cro, and there's RNA polymerase. And these numbers are typically, the overall ball part of this number is that the typical single point, single operator protein binding in is are minus 10 kilocalories per mole. And then there's some cooperative, which is kind of the energy that is needed to have something just marginally binding in the cell. And then there's some cooperativity energies, which are all of order minus 2 kilocalories per mole. Minus 2, minus 3 kilocalories per mole. There's both cooperativity in it. Yeah?
10 kilocalories per mole is compared to the unbound?
To the unbound. There is a parameter here which is not really known, and that you have to think about. That is a typical C1. So when you have something binding, here and here, then there's a binding here. Maybe this one is 12, and this is 9 kilocalories per mole, and this additional binding is of order 2 to 3 kilocalories per mole. And that's true for C1. For Cro, there's also some cooperative binding, but that's somewhat weaker. It's of order 1 kilocalories per mole. And that's somehow all measured there.
These are all in vitro.
They are all in vitro. Yes. Well, within somehow, that's of course an open question. That's really kind of this is. Could we at all, if we at any point could build models from biochemistry, this is a system where it should be possible.
Okay.
It's the best. I don't know, really know how much. You see that they are kind of quite robust. So that's kind of scanning some parameter you could imagine changing.
You're saying change
from the pH. So what is happening here is that you're changing the overall level of binding as function of this, but the distance is not changing very much. Overall level, we anyway have to deal with because we have to deal with unspecific binding. Okay. Well, so now when we start believing something like that, we also believe in equilibrium, that things are in equilibrium inside the cell, and so we have to settle whether this is stupid or it's not stupid. And the reason why I believe it's not stupid is essentially kind of a simple, very simple argument. The time for a protein to find a position in a cell, a given spot in a cell, is one protein finding one DNA binding site is given by this Smoluchowski equation, which is diffusion constant times the length of the region it has to find, times the density of the protein, which is 1 divided by the volume, if it was just 1 in the cell, and that's of order 5 seconds. It's assuming three-dimensional diffusion, yes. Here I would say that, okay, we're discussing the free protein. There's some of them are bound, but it's, yeah. You could wobble back and forth, but it's somehow for one of them that's free diffusing around, yes. So if we know that it's modified somewhat if they spent 90% of the time on the DNA, well, that means that the binding is different. The free fraction of the proteins is a factor 10 lower than. So let's just compensate. But anyway, this is for one. The point is that this is only for one protein, and there is hundreds of proteins in the system. It's not such we're discussing a system with only one or two, like in the LAC. There is of order 300 repressor molecules in the lysogen on this side. And when this side over here dominates, there is of order 400 CRO in the system. That has been measured. That's the numbers. The numbers are not of order 1. The numbers are of order a few hundred. And that's, of course, how you get these big stabilities in any case. Here I took the one from Ilovich, which is it's an estimate of the time scale. If it's equilibrium, it doesn't matter so much whether it's a factor 2 or 5 wrong. It probably depends. It was taking this, the 5 micrometer is kind of the average. Ilovich had 3 and 7 in his paper for KFP, so this is a somewhat reasonable within, I don't know how it scales with inside a cell with the size of the protein. So the on rates are of order 5, that's 5 seconds for one. If there's 100 or 50 proteins, that's 3. And it's 0.1 second for on rate. Off rates, on the other hand, they are of course down by a factor e to minus delta d over t, which essentially is kind of for this energy is of order giving the same off rate and on rates. So they are both somehow they are similar size. Of order some seconds for the off rate.
But that energy depends on you competing with the unbounded state of this non-specific.
The off rate does not. The on rate would essentially be here. It's calculated for one free protein finding. If now 90% of my proteins are bound unspecific to DNA, then I have 10% free. That would be a kind of hand waving argument. And okay, then I shouldn't put 300 proteins. I should put 30 proteins. Which way you go around it. You could also include diffusion along the DNA, and in that case, that number goes up by a factor 10 typically. But then you have 300 molecules, so maybe you have 50 for one protein, but you multiply. Yeah. You typically go up because this facilitated. Search is kind of only facilitated if there's not too much DNA around. In the coli, there's so much DNA around that actually your your facilitated search become defacilitated. You spend your time making 1D walks. 1D walks is not nice to make. It's nice if you're close to your target, but if you're far away, you're searching the same point several times. And somehow, if you try to estimate somehow how often does DNA strands cross each other and you jump from DNA strand to DNA strand, it's probably kind of, then you get a kind of factor 10 there. Yeah.
We're talking 10 kilocalories per mole mm-hmm. is a small finding. What's KT?
KT is 0.662 kilocalories per mole. And it's not a small, 10 is just marginal. 10 is just marginal. If you compare, essentially you should compare the 10 kilocalories per mole with the entropy inside a cell, the volume of the cell.
No, I'm just saying the K over K off is equal to delta G over T.
Yeah.
That delta G is this 10 kilocalories per mole?
Yeah.
That's also
entropy in there. It's 10 kilocalories per mole.
So that's E to the minus 16,
17.
Well,
but you should remember that it's not, it's actually, you have to take into account the entropy of the, it's a tau off is equal to tau on divided by the volume. If you, this k on has not the dimension, it has the dimension of molar per second. So you, and you have to multiply that with what the volume corresponds to in concentration.
Okay.
And that is giving you a factor 1 divided by 10 to the 9. So that's so around actually exactly 13 kilocalories per mole, it exactly is equal to each other. Of course.
If I lay the site over the genome, then it will just be anywhere on the genome.
Oh yeah, no, this is yeah. Now there's a whole issue here about unspecific binding. And that is kind of course. You're completely right there. This is a difference to the free. And it okay. Absolutely. Essentially, okay, let me show you some. Let me first show you. No. They are, you can estimate them.
Actually, I just downloaded the paper that the Gary gave me that has a number, but they don't match at all.
It's if it is Takeda's paper. Takeda do use another technique, and you shouldn't. His numbers are 5, 6, 7 kilocalories per mole larger than Akka's. Also, but he do use this. It's kind of a mess when you're going to. He also do his experiment at 0 degree, so it's kind of.
At 0 degree.
Celsius.
Really.
For some reason he and I don't know. It's kind of his numbers are different. The difference here is the same roughly. This kind of thing is. Especially for the crow side, he has very high. On the other hand, he also estimate the he has a measurement of the non-specific binding, which is very high also. And these two things roughly compensate each other, and so in the end it would more or less probably work out. So okay, let me show you how the curve look. Here it is as function of C1, assuming no unspecific binding. So here is shown a curve of the activity of the PRM. So this is essentially taking Akka's, plugging it in for getting the unspecific binding. This is complete theory.
With experimental
numbers. With the experimental numbers from it's in vitro. It's a consequence of in vitro on what would be predicted in vivo. In some way I should actually move ahead, but So there is actually, so here is two curves. The green curve is basically what happened in the system. So when you are at very low concentration of C1, the system is not firing very much. Let's forget about it. It is basically, if you plot in the whatever you plot in, it looks roughly like this here. Then at some level here, there's this binding of C1 to this side, and then to this side, which happens cooperatively because they have the binding here, and then it facilitates activation this here, and that goes very fast up here. This is cooperative binding that goes up. Then it saturates at some point because this the system starts, well, essentially it doesn't have more capacity at this point. It cannot fire more. It's just binding, and then it goes slowly down because C1 starts to block itself. So this is a curve for C1, for the wild type. The two other are the curves for the two mutants of little. It's the activity of the promoter for firing on the, for making C1. It's DC1, DT, essentially, on that axis. It's a DC1, and then there's a degradation, which is kind of random dilution. And you can also look at the d crow dt as function of C1 for crow equals 0. And there is a d crow dt as function of C1 for crow equals 0. Yeah. So now what is essentially happening if you put in unspecific binding is that most of your C1 are going to be bound to the DNA. So what's going to be happening here is that this little, you maybe when you have 300 molecules in your system, you actually only have maybe 100 molecules. So you stretch your curve this way. So this curve is going to move out there. So that's roughly what is happening. And similar with this one, if you put more unspecific binding, this curve does not fall so rapidly, it goes more like this here. So the more unspecific binding you put in, the more activity of the crow you get. The more unspecific binding on C1, the more unstable the system gets. Okay. The C1, what is known about C1 unspecific binding is that it's less than, there's Akers right, some measurement, it's less than 3.5 kilocalories per mole, per base pair. It's somehow not really, it's, okay, here I do, okay, let me keep it at that. I think I will leave, it's kind of technical to go into details of the unspecific binding. Okay, this here, now what is happening in this type of models is that you have DC1 DT is a production term. So let's sketch it like this here. So you have some curve like this here. This is a production. It's a curve like this here. There's a degradation. The total change in C1 is a production minus the decay, which is some curve like this here. It's DC1 DT is kind of, this is a kind of force. You can imagine that in an overdamped system, this DC1 DT would be kind of this force that drives the system. Which means that what happened in the system is that there's a stable point here, there's an unstable point here, and there's a stable point down there. So you have a stable point here, metastable point here, and you have a stable point there. And the study of the stability of this system is kind of the study of the stability in a kind of double well potential. It's a Cramer's escape from a lysogen to a lytic state. And then you can model that in different ways. What it contains is a mean potential, which is here, and then it contains some noise. And the noise you have to assume something for the noise. The more noise you put in, the more unstable the system gets. We put in the minimum noise, which is the noise of essentially that the chance that the promoter binds here, so we have random firing of the promoter here, and then the messenger RNA has a random lifetime giving a Poisson distributed production of C1 at for each messenger. So there's a fluctuation due to RNAP activation, and there's a fluctuation due to translation of the RNA.
In our group, we've been calling that shot noise.
That is probably shot noise, yes.
And is that something that anybody in the biology community recognizes?
I don't know. I think it's kind of standard, I would say. What would you say? Have you any meaning about name? So I don't know. Yes.
Does it have a name? Can we give it the name shot noise? Is that
for my, there's no problem in giving it whatever name.
It's just noise associated with things that are either 0 or 1, like order binding and unbinding, which in the physics community we would call telegraph noise. Telegraph being shot noise coming from the fact that molecules come in lumps, like bullets. Okay, so you can put in shot noise.
Put in shot noise, I put in the noise due to binding, so the RNAP as a activation of the polymerase, and due to translation of the RNA message. The noise on the two sides of the switch are different because the PR promoter has a good sequence. Close to Shine-Delgado sequence, so the messenger RNA should be fairly long-lived. It probably has something of order 20, an average of order 20 copies of proteins per messenger. On the other side, in the C1, it has somewhat lower. It's somehow of order 1 to 5 proteins per copy. It's a very bad. This has actually been measured, and is somehow a factor 20 to 70 worse than the LAC. Promoter, so it's fairly bad copy, which means that it's actually very. This is not very noisy, and this is very noisy. The crow is less noisy because essentially your noise is your activity. Well, if you you're producing rare. If you are producing 100 or some numbers of proteins, you bunch the thing.
Okay.
So it's a one with fewer with many copies, fewer firings is more noisy. Okay. To show you that we have some control over the unspecific noise, there's actually. To get the non-specific binding under control, the Crow non-specific binding can be estimated essentially. The thing gets weaker. There's one place in literature where there's found anything like properties of Crow. That is in a paper by Reinitz, which look at the phase diagram for this system. And he estimated this. He has a curve which referred to Pakula. I could not find the reference. This is showing this activity of the PR as function of Crow. So it's kind of it's showing you how much the Crow promote this PR promote goes down as function of your Crow number. And of course, if you put in no unspecific binding on the Crow, you get kind of quite tight suppression. If you put a lot of unspecific binding, you get a lot of firing, and then you can adjust and find what is your unspecific binding of Crow. So there is some bound on the Crow side. For the C1, it's kind of more like a a lower bound. This is not too bad. There's old data of C1 where this one is kind of flat within 20%. And essentially, the more unspecific, the more flat you get. But this is kind of flat enough to be consistent with data. It's flat enough to be consistent with. So, OK. I shouldn't say that. It's really details. It's really details. OK, you plot this into the simulations, and you get something.
Wait, you have the same curve you just showed for the contract?
For what?
For the other curve that you have. So that's only as a function of C1.
This was a function of C1, and this is of a function of crow. For C1,
this
I
is only for the wild type. I want the 1-2-1 and the 3-2-3.
I don't have them. They don't exist. That would be very nice to have them. I don't have them. Nobody have them at present. It's the data.
Where did you get that? Those plots from?
This one was only taken biochemistry from C1, without any non-specific binding. If I put in non-specific binding. Essentially, what happened is that the curves here get stretched out there because what this hunter here is, it's kind of, so what's happened, if you look at these two types.
These are calculations based on Acker's data,
yes, with zero unspecific binding.
Right, but he had the same data, he had the same results for Crow as he did for C1.
Yes, so I could also show them, oh yeah, I have them, sure, and that is what I plug in here, essentially, the green curve.
Only for the wild type, you didn't do it for 1-2-1.
No, I could. I have them, so that I can do very fast. That's
what I wanted to do.
Okay, sure. No, sure. That's just not. It's not measured. You can, of course, you need to have them to do the calculation. Okay. Fine. So, you let me summarize here. Kind of. I don't think we should go on beyond the coffee break, because we have actually. So essentially, kind of the picture is kind of like this here. For the wild type, you get some fluctuation in the nitrogen, like this here, some small spikes in the crow activity. The crow activity is very low. And then at some point it breaks down. This is in numbers of generations. There's many, many generations here. So it takes some generations to build up to breaking down. And the reason it takes some generation is because C1 is degraded quite. You have to somehow build up some crow, and then you have to sustain a high crow level to suppress C1, because C1 is not disappearing just because you have a lot of crow. The C1 has to it's only disappearing because it's diluted due to cell division.
So the breakdown is spontaneous?
It's spontaneous. This is random. So if you plug in this parameters, you basically get something like that, which is somewhat reasonable for the wild type. So you can essentially, and then you can look at it in some phase diagram, and you basically conclude that if you stopped here, you conclude that the model basically works. If you have one data point and you have one parameter to fiddle with, the parameter here being kind of the activity of the crow promoter, the overall level of the firing here. Well, it's not really a free parameter. It's also fixed in Reinitz's paper, and it actually fits reasonably well with that value because he measure how much crow is in a substrate. Let me let's get so. But what doesn't work is essentially. When you now plug in the other formula. So if you do the same simulation, plug it in, you get for respectively this system and this system. You can see that it predicts a level of C1. Its intersection of this curve is a amount of C1 in the olecithin, and that's actually quite well what Little is measuring. But it does not, and it gives stability of this system. It does not at all give stability of that system. That is essentially because of the crow side is firing so much, and that means that the thing is the system is switching to what's called the anti-immune state. That it has only one stable state. It is a state. The state it has, that's stable, is a state where crow fire and locks itself down here. So just fire on the crow side. The crow goes over and block here and start blocking itself. There's essentially no C1 in the system. So what you are, if you're plugging in your system, the crow takes over. It goes down to block itself down, but it blocks C1 completely down. So it immediately goes down there. Now you could. Because of this here, because essentially the crow, also because of the slope of the intersection. This is very close to each other, so the whole thing is very unstable. The integral is somehow, this slope is, and now you could argue that, of course, you could change the C1 unspecific binding. What happened then is that you move this curve this way to put more unspecific binding, and that would just make things worse. Well, then the whole it would collapse even without having crow. So it's simply kind of tough to get this to work. So what then? Well, now there's some level on I will be sketchy now. There's one level more in this system that is known, also due to something happening last year. And that is that this complex is not acting alone. This complex is actually bending over and binding to this complex. So C1 binds to operator right and binds to operator left simultaneously, finding a closed system like this. And this has been measured to have, if you measure it simply by measuring the activity of the promoters here and here, with and without the operator left. And you see that the activity of PR changed by a factor 4 when you remove operator left. The activity of PRM changed by a factor 2 when you remove operator left. So this two data, this data is published. This data is somehow being developed by Ian Dodd in Australia just now. It optimizes, so it's a dimer and a dimer tetramer. Actually, it's known that it's making an optimum because it only works when you have two operator left sides right here, and then it goes over one bind there. And actually, it's a fact because you see it in vivo. You see that the effect is there in vivo, so it has to be doing. If you do the whole system without having operator left, just having DNA, it doesn't happen. It does not happen either if you just have one operator left binding site here.
Now that is not known.
Which combinations here are doing with this? Which combinations there? But presumably all possible octamers.
I don't care about the DNA, but I just want to know how the octamer binds together.
There's only guesses on that now. It looks like it could work if one look at the crystal structure. Ravi and Müller Hill has some, but it's kind of this is not. Probably you can, but it's easier to just remove this one. Then you don't have the. Then you don't have the system. So what is happening is that, well, you can actually model the system because you actually know the bindings here, and you know that it's a factor 2 on that side and a factor 4 on that side, and that gives you a typical binding, a factor somehow like this one comes over and suppresses time by a factor 4, that's around 1 kilocalories per mole effective binding. Surprisingly weak. Well, it goes down there and represses 3/4 of the time on this side. It's of course not the real strength of the binding because you pay a lot of entropy. These sites are 3,000 base pair from each other, 2,000-3,000 base pair from each other. Surprisingly long. You have to bend this around inside this strange cell where there's the density of DNA is somehow 15 nanometers between two DNA strands, and you have to bend around 50 DNA strands and reach this site. And it actually does it. Yeah, well, except that probably, I don't know, actually, yes. In equilibrium, it's not so far away, but it has to go there, and 40,000. Okay, yes, I believe that's true. Okay, so of course you can model this here, and it works. And the upshot of going to this next level, where you have to invoke some more states, of course, because now there are three more states that be occupied there, is that it doesn't really change anything for the problem with operator 3, 3, 2, 3. What actually changes the thing for 3, 2, 3 is probably that something is lacking in the system, obviously. It doesn't help to put more unspecific binding, that's clear. What is probably the case is that we have a system here which is kind of having a Kramers potential. So you had this state here, number of C1, and there's one state here and one state here, which is Lysogen. And the stability is kind of the height of this barrier, which is actually not C1, but the height here is given by something like Kro concentrations and C1 concentrations in Lysogen relative to here. So stability is something of an exponential of this kind of effective potential. This effective potential is given by numbers of Kro and numbers of this and that, which again means that it's given by exponentials of binding energies. So it's E to some delta G. Essentially some Kro minus C1. That's somehow the reason you get very stable thing is when it's stable is that you have a Kramers trapping. But on the other hand, you have a very little robust system because you exponentiate exponential, where you have a difference. The thing that probably is acting here is that Kro and C1 are not that competitive. They are probably helping each other in some way. And one way they could help each other is that Kro and C1 could bind cooperatively to each other, which is not included in any present measurement. So if you just add a little bit cooperative interaction with C1 and Kro, and spice it up with a little bit that Kro actually, when it binds to the DNA, it bends the DNA. So probably it will break any kind of Kro binding here, will break this bond. Then you can actually stabilize the 3-2-3 mutants. But this is purely speculative, of course. We lack some measurement of there lacks something in the system. Yeah? No, except that Kro and Kro binds cooperatively to each other, and C1 and C1 bind cooperatively to each other. So it's not completely impossible that Kro and C1 have some interaction with each other. But that has not been measured. There's several reasons for looking at that particular option. There's other parts. Drew was mentioning that there's a Rex A system here, Rex A, Rex B, that is between C1, and that could have a function. But the problem with putting in this case, with imagining other components playing a role here, is that then you first need to get these other molecules to sit around this complex. And if you want to have another molecule sitting around this complex, you first have to pay your 10 kilocalories per mole binding. And that's kind of quite a lot. And then it can start doing something. Whereas if you do it with the molecules you have around, you can do it with a few kilocalories per mole. So that's the current guess of how it should work. Okay. So I summarize. So it's remarkably stable, the lambda phage, and surprisingly robust. And the last thing probably means that something is lacking in our current understanding. And then show my collaborators somehow. Jäger Rell from Stockholm, helping with the mathematics of the trauma's escape. Stanley Brown is a biologist, Copenhagen, which is helping us to model, to test some of this idea, especially together with Christopher Beck. We looked at the PIE so there's other options of keeping the stability in the system. You have to, it's not only this, there could be something like when you have this talk of Doyle, you should just somehow imagine that there's some other things happening somewhere else. And what could happen is that the promoter for establishments of repression over here. So you remember that when you establish, that was important. So maybe when you go out, that one is also important, that it could somehow rescue you on the edge of chaos, of disaster. And the way it could rescue you is, of course, that when this one crow starts to fire, it somehow sneaks past here, and it gets its C2 activated. What normally happens in when you have reg A in the system, when you have normal lysergy, then there's a little operator here, OOP, that fire this way, and stop the signal, but now you don't have reg A, so maybe the C2 could activate PIE and go back and rescue your system. But when you remove PIE, which we did, or we got some strain from Harvey Eisen, then it doesn't change the stability, essentially, of the wild type. We didn't do it on the 1-2-1 and 3-2-3. So it's and then we have some attempts here. We want to, of course, know what the activity on the crow and the C1 is on the in the lysogenic state, and that for that we set up some GFP measurement, setting GFP on the two sides. So that's Sine Svenningsen and Christopher Beck. Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Yes.
So let's look at this. So this result was calculated from Akers' data, right?
Yeah.
Where's
that table? Yeah. Yes. Oh. This one is, this is calculated directly from Akers' data without any unspecific binding.
Right.
And.
But so the question is, what would happen if I plotted this graph as a function of crow concentration? So now what's going to happen is this curve
that is roughly
much lower.
So that's PR. That is PR. This is roughly looking like this here. That's roughly this green curve. So that is a PR as function of crow. That's a green.
That's just the wild type line.
I
want this line.
You want this one. Okay.
And this line. So if that's the wild type line, then the other line is going to look like this.
It is going to be looking something like that.
It's going to switch where this curve suddenly becomes much, much
less.
That's true. So now what I want to know is the real activity of PR, which is a combination of both the effects of C1 and crow at the
same time.
So I think if you do that, in fact, PR is actually less active in this mutant than it is
in the chromated state. It's true. But that's first when it has gone to the crow state.
Well, I think the total amount of the question is, how much crow is there going to be in a cell?
Yeah.
The total concentration of crow in this, when you have this operator versus when you have the wild type.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you're going to have less crow in this cell than in the wild type cell.
That is true. I think that's true. But it has the thing is that the 3-2-3 when you is kind of going to be in the crow domain, it's only having existing in the anti-immune state. It where it has less, this state where it has a lot of crow, it's not, it, when it isn't.
But You keep saying it has a lot of crow. I think it has less.
It has less crow when it's in the lysis state. When it's in the lysogenic state, it has more crow. It depends on whether you look at it along the C1. So it's true. It's two dimensional. So it has a C1 here and it has a crow here. So it has less here and it has more here. And it has so what's happening is that it switches over to that one where it has less. That's true. So it would be, but I cannot keep it here because this one it really pushes itself away from here.
Because when you're in a lysogenic state, the concentration of crow is irrelevant. It's just it's just only the binding of C1, and you're saying that the balance tips towards a crow.
The balance tips towards a crow. Yes.
So it's still at the point where crow is basically non-existent, but
you're looking. Yeah, as soon as a crow gets dominating, it's not getting that dominating as in the other state. That's true. I can just not keep it. I simply cannot keep it in the lysogenic state. What it does immediately is that it goes to a state where there's essentially no C1, and then there's not so much crow. I think that's true. But it must be true, as you say. It's not. There's a factor probably something less crow.
Probably 100-fold less.
No, the crow.
Crow binds to OR3 100-fold better than OR1.
That is true. 100-fold less. That's a good question. Whether that much is.
Well, so that's not, what I was looking for.
Probably not that.
The data.
Yes.
You had
yes.
At the very beginning.
Yes. I should. I won't look at it. We'll have to. That is certainly. It's not 100-fold. It's not. The thing with the crow are not that violent. So this was. Mm-hmm. Yeah, let's see. Boom. Here's an echo.
Doesn't this have enough data that you could actually do these curves for crow?
Of course. Okay. I can do it. I can do anything.
Okay, I thought you were saying you didn't have enough information to do.
I have enough data to do anything if I believe this is true. It's whether you disbelieve this data. That's kind of the.
See, that's two orders of magnitude difference between binding to OR3 and OR.
OR1.
So it's going to shut itself off. Quite a lot. Above a 100-fold smaller concentration. Right. So it's only going to rise to 1/100th as much as it would normally have before it turns itself off.
It's not going completely.
Crow turns itself off only binding at the rightmost operator. It doesn't care what it doesn't. It only binds. It turns itself off when it binds here. It doesn't matter what happens at these two positions.
Yeah.
So when it binds here, is when it gets turned off. And if this is.
Now it's not. You should one thing.
This is in the backwards.
That seems
crow over here.
Peculiar. Now I'm really kind of. It's not really kind of in the. It's not that much suppression in the wild type. The crow suppression is not that efficient. Somehow in this curve this is really only from Reinitz's old paper. He had a paper on and he say that the anti-immune state is somewhere around here.
Right, but that's because you have OR1.
So you see when the
question is if you replaced OR1 with OR2.
I know. Then you're moving this one essentially to order of magnitude. So that means that you say that that will of course not happen. Then the crew will not go completely over there. That's true.
I think you need to have this same.
I have them of course in the simulation. I need to have them. I need to have every. It is just a one-dimensional cut in a. I just plug in the hole. I need to have. Everything is function of both crow and C1, which is trivial to get from this here. Let me simply cut it out.
You can make this plot. It tells you what the x activity of PR. So you could have a plot where the third dimension is the activity of PR, the activity of PRM, as a function of both of these two proteins.
Yeah, I can very easily make that, yes.
And what you want to do is you want to do that, so you want to do it for one graph for PR, another graph for PRM, and you want to do it for all three operators.
I want to do it for all.
Wild type, one-to-one.
Yeah. That I can make.
And then you have a graph that was like this that told you what the activity. But then the real question is the dynamics of what happens during and what becomes stable. And what
it's what I have in the computer. This graph, of course.
Okay.
I have this.
I'd be interested to see.
Let me plot them out. I need them to do anything here somehow. The 1-2-1 is more kind of, it doesn't really have an anti-immune state actually. So I'm kind of there, it's kind of funny, it rebounds immediately, it goes down. So when you look at this here, the 1-2-1 is so close to zero that already this concentration, the basal firing is kind of.
The C1 concentration never gets very high. But of course, at that point, you've already turned off. I mean, the other thing that's funny about this graph is this is log scale. So this is a thousandfold effect.
Yeah, exactly.
And this is a tenfold effect.
Absolutely. Right? Absolutely. So but it's because this one is
right.
This exactly. is active state.
But the point is, in the small C1, at a fairly small C1 concentration, which you get in this mutant, it only gets up to 25% of its wild type level. But already at 25% of its wild type level, you've turned the crow off. The same as you would in the wild type, down to less than 10% activity, so 5% activity.
Yes. And it's not so harmful. It's kind of right.
So I'm not surprised that one behaves more or less like wild type.
Yeah. The 3-2-3, it's really, but it's true what you're saying, that of course the crow will not say factor 100.
It's a factor of 100, just based on.
I see your point. My feeling is that it's.
And it's self-limiting.
It's
crow is always self-limiting.
Self-limiting.
Wild type, it's limiting to level x.
Yeah. And in another
3-2-3, it should be limiting to the level of 0.01x. I mean, only 1% on this.
But that would be zero, because there's only like 400 nanomolar in the anti-immune state. So what you're saying is and that's somehow not fitting. It's too much.
It really turns itself off so completely. It has to make a little bit to turn itself off, but the amount made is very small in the 3-2-3 situation. Small a number of then bringing in the non-specific binding is going to be important.
But actually that I bring in for the crew, I bring it in simply by this. I use it to bring it in here. They have this curve to do it with.
Right.
For the C1, I have now from this kind of it doesn't work anymore.